I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Alligator Alcatraz is gone. Just a year after Governor Ron DeSantis had the migrant detention center erected in the middle of the Everglades, and after spending more than $1 billion on it, he announced its closure last month, and by last weekend it was completely dismantled. DeSantis claims the controversial state-run facility made Florida safer. But it was a national lightning rod for accusations of cruel and often racist abuse of its immigrant detainees, not to mention the environmental damage it posed. Two questions loom now. First, what will become of the site itself? Environmental groups want to turn it into a nature preserve, and Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava is urging the county to sell it to Everglades National Park. But there are moral issues to unpack as well. Given what many legal and human rights advocates described as Alligator Alcatraz's inhumane conditions and cynical political aims. What sort of mark did this unprecedented immigration enforcement spectacle leave on Florida? We'd like to hear your thoughts about Alligator Alcatraz. Was it all worth it? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Eve Sample. She's executive director of the environmental nonprofit Friends of the Everglades, which fought to close Alligator Alcatraz. Also with us is Bacardi Jackson, Florida executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Eve Samples, Friends of the Everglades and other environmental organizations had sued to get Alligator Alcatraz shut down. You'd argued that it was actually a federal and not a state facility, and therefore it was violating federal environmental standards, but a federal appeals court disagreed and kept it open. So what do you think finally pushed Governor DeSantis to close it, and how surprised were you that he did?
So our lawsuit at Friends of the Everglades with our allies is still active, and we do believe that the pressure that was applied both inside the courtroom and outside of it led the government, the state and federal government, to shut this facility down much earlier than they planned. The public records show they intended to keep Alligator Alcatraz open for 2 or even 3 years, and we saw them shut it down at a year. And that was not as soon as we had hoped for. But it was clear that in response to our lawsuit to enforce federal environmental laws, in which they claimed they hadn't applied for federal funding, that created pressure in Tallahassee, where state lawmakers on both sides of the aisle didn't want to be footing the bill for this immense cost at a moment when DOGE was in the air.
Yeah.
And that created pressure that led the government to retreat. And you know, what was once a political slogan for the backers of this inhumane and harmful project became a political liability. We also sued the state of Florida for public records that revealed the scope of waste of taxpayer dollars, about $1 million a day, about $1 billion, most of it for Alligator Alcatraz. So the thing that people remember most is upwards of $90 million for the porta potty contractor.
Right.
So, yes, we believe that that led the state and federal government to shut this facility down sooner, and we're glad it did, but the work continues.
Bacardi Jackson, as I mentioned, on top of the environmental damage critics said this detention center wrought in the Everglades, the accusations of inhumane conditions and treatment of migrants there had just kept mounting. Governor DeSantis claimed the facility was always supposed to be a temporary facility. But do you think he and the Trump administration decided, apart from the cost, that this had become too big a public relations debacle with midterm elections coming up, for example, and polls showing that most voters in Florida and the United States aren't really on board with the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in many ways? Either way, were you surprised by this move?
You know, with the official closure of this Alligator Alcatraz, it's really sealed its reputation as a ruinous venture. It's a monument to what happens when a state government abandons its conscience and serves a federal cruelty agenda. The DeSantis administration deliberately built a detention facility in the middle of the Everglades, not despite the harsh conditions, but because of them. And as mentioned, spent over $1 billion of Florida taxpayers' money to do it. And you may recall the morbid jokes and even this cruel nickname that inaugurated this cruel facility.
Yeah.
Several public officials made these jokes about alligators attacking immigrants. It's a throwback to the playbook of our darkest parts of our nation's history. And it's not governance, it's cruelty dressed up as policy. And it's interesting because this has backfired. Floridians overall have not been moved by this appeal to cruelty to accept the dehumanization of people who are deeply integrated in our communities as caregivers, as service workers, as trusted neighbors, friends, educators, and other critical role. So hundreds of thousands of Floridians have protested, organized, called their legislators, and they have refused to look away. They made this moment possible, and we should name that
So
clearly.
you weren't too surprised then when Governor DeSantis made the closure announcement last month?
Well, I think it's always surprising to see what appears to be the right move, but I think it was inevitable because people of Florida are not going to stand for this kind of cruelty, nonsense, and waste of their resources.
So, Eve Samples, lay out for us what you and your colleagues feel are the worst points of environmental and wildlife habitat damage that alligator Alcatraz did out there in the Everglades, in that area west of Miami-Dade County near Okeechobee in the Big Cypress National Preserve, where that Dade Collier airstrip is located. It's sort of a fraught site, obviously, but what's your assessment in that regard?
Yes, so Alligator Alcatraz was built in the worst place possible, surrounded by Big Cypress National Preserve, our country's first national preserve, in an area that was fought for 50 years ago. Marjory Stoneman Douglas founded Friends of the Everglades in 1969 to protect this very same location from a major airport at that time. So that's why we sued, and we sued to have the government analyze the environmental impacts. We wanted them to do that before the facility opened. They didn't do that. So we assessed, to the best of our ability, the impacts. And what we documented was at least 20 acres of new pavement laid at this site in the middle of the Everglades. You can't lay a patio in your backyard in Florida without a permit, but they laid 20 acres of new pavement. And when rainwater hits that pavement and pollutants are carried into the surrounding wetlands, there are real risks. High intensity lighting was brought in, stadium style lighting that negatively impacts Florida panther habitat, an endangered species, to the tune of about 2,000 acres of Florida panther habitat impacted, according to experts that testified during our court hearings. Hazardous materials in and out every day. We're talking jet fuel in, sewage out, because remember, there's no infrastructure at this site.
Yeah.
And we did receive reports of a sewage spill. So we're calling for a transparent assessment of the extent of this damage now.
And we should also point out the Miccosukee tribe who that resides out in that area was also a partner in your litigation, right?
Yes, a very important partner. Thank you for raising that. And access to important tribal sites and lands has been cut off as a result of this facility being open. And actually, some of it remains inaccessible.
Bacardi Jackson, let's turn to the legal and human rights damage you and other critics feel Alligator Alcatraz wrought, the conditions and treatment, but also the legal rights you and other immigrant advocate organizations had filed suit over, such as lack of access to legal counsel and violations of due process for the more than 20,000 migrants who were detained and deported there. What were the worst infractions in that regard?
Yeah, thank you. This site was built out of temporary tents, trailers, chain link fences with barbed wire, along with the tools of torture and abuse. And it was surrounded by alligators, pythons, swampland. This remote location, its fragile infrastructure raised serious safety concerns. In addition to inhumane conditions like maggot-infested food, overflowing toilets that spilled into sleeping areas, as mentioned, 24-hour fluorescent floodlights. Assault by guards, denial
His
of
decisions.
prescription medications, flooding, hurricane risk, mosquito infestations. People were also being denied their constitutional right to access counsel, including in-person attorney visits, confidential communications with their counsel, and secure document exchanges. So this violated First Amendment protections. And with no clear process for legal access, individuals are left without a meaningful ability to challenge their detention. So we sued in July, and in March, the court ordered ICE to provide people detained at the facility access to legal counsel and certify the case as a class action to ensure that all people who were at that facility had right to access that counsel. And we also address and are still addressing some of the worst abuses. We, along with Sanctuary of the South, we filed notice of a demand letter to federal and state authorities on behalf of two men who were brutally assaulted by guards there. So, yes, all kinds of abuses and constitutional violations.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Bacardi Jackson of ACLU Florida and Eve Samples of the Friends of the Everglades about the closing of Alligator Alcatraz. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Eve Samples, I want to talk about what happens now with that Everglades site that Alligator Alcatraz sat on for a year. Your organization has released a 5-point plan you call Remediation, Restoration, and Protection of the Everglades after Alligator Alcatraz. Now, it's addressed to Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava, but the mayor herself is urging the county to sell the land now to Everglades National Park. Take us through what you hope happens next.
Right. So the hallmark of Alligator Alcatraz has been chaos and secrecy. And what we're calling for is the opposite of that. Now that the facility has been closed to detained immigrants and apparently a cleanup is happening. But again, there's been no transparency or public access so far. So we want a formal process for stakeholder review and input, first and foremost, also prohibition of harmful development at this site in the future. An independent site assessment to guide remediation. We need to know the extent of the damage out there to fragile Everglades wetlands that taxpayers at the state and federal level have invested billions of dollars to restore. Also, a mandatory review and environmental regulatory compliance in the future. And then finally, and this one has captured the imagination a bit, we think there needs to be an independent analysis of the costs and the benefits of removing that original 1969 runway at the site.
The airstrip, right? That is.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That runway has been a dam in the Everglades for a half a century. As long as it remains, it will be vulnerable to harmful development like this.
Yeah.
And we need to take a really hard look at what should happen next there.
Okay. Bacardi Jackson, going back to that suit I mentioned that the ACLU and other immigrant advocates had filed to restore the legal rights of migrants that you feel Alligator Alcatraz did so much to erode in this state, if not the country. Even if the facility is now shut down, what do groups like yours still plan to do now in terms of litigation to address what did happen there and to prevent it from happening again?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we continue with some of our litigation and legal actions. We will not allow the state to backtrack and distract from its failed political stunt and tolerate the destruction of evidence or conceal its abuses. Nobody should be treated the way people who were being detained at that facility were treated. And to be clear, this is still happening. As people are transferred to other facilities, the abuses don't disappear. They relocate. The shell game that's being played with human lives all across this country seems very intentional. Relocations happen just before court dates. People are being disappeared from databases so family members and attorneys can't find them or can no longer represent them in new jurisdictions. And even what appears to be prolonged detentions of people who request to be self-deported, but still being held for months at great expense of taxpayers and for windfall profits to contractors.
Okay.
So, you know, we will continue to follow suit. We will not allow this administration, not only the ACLU of Florida, but all the affiliates across this nation are looking at these issues and attacking these abuses. And we will continue to stand with our communities to tell the stories. The stories have to be told.
Jimena in Boca Raton is on the line, very frustrated with this issue. Jimena, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your perspectives?
My perspective is that Governor DeSantis should be prosecuted, put in jail for approving this inhumane place using our taxpayers' money. He just wanted to be a mini Trump, and he got his wishes. I'm not American by birth. I'm American by, you know, because I chose to be an American, and I'm short of language and vocabulary, but I will express this is a very inhumane treatment of people. They're not dogs. They are only, you know, yes, they might be some criminals, but not even a dog is treated the way that he submitted people in the Alcatraz place. He should be prosecuted and put in jail.
Okay. Well, Jimena, thanks very much for your call. Eve, that strong feeling she's expressed there sort of brings me to the last question I wanted to ask you and Bacardi about the legacy that this year-long, project on Governor DeSantis' part leaves for this state. What's your conclusion? Critics say, you know, it was a political stunt. Governor DeSantis said it made Florida safer, but it left a lot of trauma that Ximena just expressed. What's your conclusion?
We think it was a very low point in Everglades history. It really neglected the history of this site that so many Floridians have fought for over the decades. And then in the context of the caller's question, I just want to highlight the irony. This was built, proposed, under purported rule of law reasons. And in the process, the state and federal government defied the rule of environmental laws. And you know, our friends at the ACLU have made important points about other laws that were ignored. So Alligator Alcatraz defied rule of law, and there's really painful irony in that, and that will be remembered.
Just quickly, Eve, though, has it, though, perhaps heightened public awareness of Everglades conservation?
Yes, you know, we've been heartened by support from across the country, people who are now attuned to what Big Cypress National Preserve is, an incredible place in the heart of the Everglades. The awareness has increased, and that is, in fact, a silver lining.
Bacardi Jackson, the same question to you. What's the legacy of Alligator Alcatraz?
You know, this is a really sad legacy for our state. It is one of the darkest moments of our history, I think, in our lifetimes, to see this kind of abuse, to see this kind of intentional stoking of hatred. But it's not going to work. We have overcome this in the past. We will overcome it now. And I think the legacy will be that Floridians will say never again, that we will put in place a stronger democracy, a more inclusive democracy, and we will stop all of these kinds of overreach by the state that is outside of constitutional norms and values. This isn't just about a particular group of people who certainly are being demonized and attacked and dehumanized, but this is about all of us. And all of us have a stake in holding on to the rule of law and our constitutional values. So that will be the ultimate legacy, is we will win because it is our duty to do that.
Bacardi Jackson is the executive director of the ACLU of Florida. Eve Samples is the executive director of Friends of the Everglades. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Palm Beach County rejects the IA data center known as Project Tango. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. AI, and especially the massive data centers that create artificial intelligence, are a hot-button issue in the U.S. right now, and perhaps nowhere more than in Florida. The inordinate space they take, the outsized electricity and water they consume, and the unwelcome noise they can make has residents in places like Palm Beach County pushing back on AI data centers, despite the economic boon they promise. The AI data center proposal in Palm Beach County, called Project Tango, was seen as a national test of local tolerance. And this week, Tango failed. The Palm Beach County Commission voted 5-1 to reject the 3.6 million square feet hyperscale plan slated for the rural Arden area of Loxahatchee. The decision came after a marathon 12-hour hearing that drew an overflow and heated crowd. Let us know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, who's been covering the Project Tango drama from the beginning. Wilkin, how are you?
Hey, all is well. Tim, how are you?
Great to hear it. Thanks. I'm doing great. So set us up here, Wilkin. Remind us what Project Tango is or was and why it created so much controversy, if not tension, in Palm Beach County when it was first proposed.
First of all, Tim, I think tension is an understatement.
Especially what you saw on this week. Yeah.
Yeah, I was there for that 12 hours. It was rough. And so just for starters, Project Tango was a proposed massive 3.6 million square foot hyperscale AI data center campus in the western part of Palm Beach County, which is near the Loxahatchee area, quite a rural part of the county. And it would have occupied about 202-acre site near the Arden Residential Community and Saddleview Elementary School. And for months, Tim, the project was the center of a major community standoff, not only for the facility's proximity to homes and schools, but largely due to concerns from residents across the county regarding noise, electricity, and what took a lot of space during the commission meeting, water consumption.
Right. But originally, we should point out, the Palm Beach County Commission seemed to be in favor of this project, no? Or am I exaggerating?
Yeah, they were in favor of it to a large extent until the Zoning Commission recently voted 6-0, saying, hey, look, this isn't some sort of a light industrial project. This is much bigger than they had anticipated. And so, yeah, things switched up pretty quickly.
Became a more radioactive political issue, yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, before we get to this week's vote, there was first some drama in court that led to this week's vote, right? What was that all about?
Well, there was a competing, much smaller co-owner of the facility who said that they wanted to postpone this vote because they felt, and this facility, I believe it's called West Palm Beach. I can't remember the actual name of the organization, but they are the co-owner of the same land that PBA Holdings owns. And so they wanted to postpone that vote because they felt that they would be economically impacted should Project Tango go forward and not be and not have their say into the matter.
Okay. But a judge ruled that the vote could go ahead.
The vote could go ahead. Yep.
So about that vote, in your report this week, you mentioned that this week's Palm Beach County Commission vote was not about stopping Project Tango construction entirely, right? So what was it about?
Right. So the developers had already secured approvals back in 2016 for a smaller standard data center. And that's the operative word, standard.
Yeah.
Because AI, the technology from 2016 versus 2026 is drastically different.
Okay, standard as opposed to hyperscale as we're describing it today.
Absolutely. And that's a very important distinction. Yeah. A standard data center would have computers that won't require that much energy from water resources, for example. So we want to make that clear. So 2016, it was approved for a smaller standard data center and warehouse footprint, about 2 million square feet. Okay. And so Wednesday's vote was specifically about their request to nearly double the site's development rights to 3.6 million square feet, so they could build a power-hungry hyperscale AI facility. And of course, the commission voted 5-1 to deny that expansion.
So is there a chance we could still see a Project Tango, facility move forward in that Loxahatchee area of Palm Beach County if it's perhaps scaled down?
Yes, absolutely. And a much smaller form because, again, the 2016 zoning approvals remain legally valid. And so the developer still has the right to build a standard 206 square foot data center alongside the 1.2 million square feet of warehouses.
Okay.
Now, we call this hearing Wednesday a quasi-judicial hearing. And so following that 12-hour hearing, developer Ernie Cox, who represents Project Tango, said they are evaluating their next steps to move forward with the pre-approved 2016 plan.
Now, even so, the commission's vote was pretty decisive, 5-1 against Project Tango. And that also signals a fairly decisive level of public opposition. Here's an Arden community leader, Raymond Pinwala, offering the commission his argument.
You're not voting on Project Tango specifically, although technically you are. You're voting on the precedent to allow a hyperscale AI data center to be built anywhere in the county.
So he's urging the county there not to set an AI data center approval precedent, or at least a precedent that would approve this hyperscale facility. As we mentioned, the Palm Beach County Commission meeting had an overflow and pretty heated crowd in attendance. Wilkin, describe what you saw and heard there, both the commission and the community. What were the big objections, environmental and otherwise?
I mean, where do we start?
Yeah.
So the proposed site was just 900 to 1200 feet from Saddleview Elementary. Let's start there. There's a lot of parents who arrived at the meeting with their children. I've never seen so many kids at a commission meeting. There were concerns about low frequency hum of massive cooling fans running 24/7. Homeowners insurance, which is a topic most people haven't brought up, was brought up this Wednesday because a lot of folks felt that that wasn't mentioned in the early start of the conversation, which, you know, really took off in December of 2025. The project's power demands, the daily water usage were a massive concern. It would use more than 100,000 gallons of water a day. Developers said that the data center would use what's called a closed loop cooling system, which recirculates a fixed volume of water and reduced freshwater consumption. But they did not convince residents or the commissioners about how contaminated water would be discharged. Not enough guardrails for most of the proposals. And so that's what Commissioner Brian Flores essentially stressed as well.
Now, but Commissioner Maria Marino was the sole yes vote. Here's her take.
My 91-year-old mom texted me and said, "We need data centers in Palm Beach County. If we don't have them, they're going to go somewhere else. And if I were to be voting today, I would vote yes."
So, Wilkin, what was the justification that she and other community supporters of the center voiced for approving Project Tango?
A lot of people's clapping during the commission meeting or, you know, clapping in approval and sharing their vocal expressions of disapproval. That was one of the statements where people were absolutely shocked. And so as the lone dissenting vote, Commissioner Marino stated she supported the project because the developer had agreed to comply with all of the county's strict customized protective conditions designed to shield the nearby Arden neighborhood and the elementary school from the negative impacts or potential impacts of the data center.
Okay. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus about Palm Beach County's rejection of the AI data center proposal known as Project Tango. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Wilkin, we were talking before about where this week's vote actually leaves Project Tango, and you said you mentioned that the developers still think that perhaps this project could move forward. How did they respond to all this?
Yeah, so PBA Holdings lawyer Brian Seymour, the project manager Ernie Cox, and their team were there to defend the project, though their arguments just struggled to win over the board. The Project Tango team tried to frame the AI data center as a light industrial project, and you heard that term quite often. And so light industrial versus heavy industrial is essentially the intensity of the impact on the surrounding area, like how much noise, traffic, and pollution the project creates. And to
denying the hyperscale, quote, hyperscale label that has been put on the center?
In the eyes of the board and residents, yes. They were using old terms to describe the intensity of the AI data center and essentially using terms that would describe the 2016 data center. And that's completely different. Project Tango is a 600 megawatt power demand, which is 12 times the state's 50 megawatt threshold for large-scale data
centers.
That's
good context. Thanks for that.
Yeah. And that will obviously trigger stricter regulatory oversight. And so that was a huge difference. And so it was hard to really convince the board otherwise. Yeah. And so they tried to agree to strict conditions that the county staff had put out there, including an 850-foot setback from the property line. They tried to create a 1,700-foot buffer between the AI data center and the Arden community and the school itself. They also offered to move cooling systems indoors, shift louder equipment away from neighbors, and use all sorts of different ways to try to, like, limit the disruption. But it just did not sway the board.
Well, do the developers then seem resigned to having to downscale this project in order to keep it alive or not?
And that's the thing. How do you downsize it if the state's measurements, they're trying to fit it all into the comprehensive plan and it's not compatible?
So it's
logistically.
It's going to be difficult, yeah.
It's going to be very difficult.
If they had to do that. Looking forward, though, Wilkin, are there any other data center proposals in Florida, and especially South Florida, that are worth taking note of? I know, for example, four other data centers in Florida have been blocked as well recently, but what do you believe this week's vote might signify for the future of data centers here?
Yeah, Tim. Wednesday was it was a major turning point. There's no other way to put it. It was a major turning point for tech infrastructure in all of Florida. It proves that local governments are no longer willing to rubber stamp massive AI projects under outdated zoning codes. And so Palm Beach County commissioners recently voted 7-0 to advance a formal moratorium, basically a pause on future large-scale AI data centers so they can officially rewrite the zoning rules. Yeah. And so moving forward, developers should expect that any proposal for a facility exceeding the state's 50 megawatt threshold. Again, Project Tango was 600 megawatt.
Yeah.
Any new project would be met with a lot of skepticism because it has to prove compatibility.
No. You're making the good point that this sends a real message to developers for future projects here. But just in the minute we have left here, Wilkin, what about the national impact of this week's Palm Beach County vote? AI data centers, as I mentioned, are a lightning rod across the country right now. What sort of national bellwether do you think Palm Beach County becomes now?
It's funny you said, I believe it was Commissioner Marcy Woodward who mentioned that this is a national spotlight. It wasn't just residents from the western part of Palm Beach County who showed up. There were podcasters, there were YouTubers there. There were all sorts of different activists and regulatory groups who showed up at the commission meeting. It was an overflow crowd. And so Palm Beach County is in a national spotlight. And had they voted to approve this, it would have been chaos for a lot of activist groups. And so, so we'll see what happens next.
Yep. Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilkin, many thanks for your great reporting on this story.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tim.
Still to come, Argentina is advancing to the World Cup finals, but the Argentine Football Association is under an FBI probe. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett.
Messi resets. Messi driving in. Messi crossing back. Post, there it is. Lautaro Martinez. Stoppage time. Go ahead goal for Argentina.
On Wednesday, Lionel Messi and Argentina did it again in this Men's Soccer World Cup, as called there by Fox Sports. Coming from behind in the waning minutes of a must-win game to engineer a near-miraculous victory. This time it was a 2-1 semifinal win over England, sending Argentina to the final against Spain on Sunday. La Albiceleste, as Argentina is known, will be playing for a second consecutive World Cup championship. Win or lose, Argentina is the world soccer juggernaut, not just on the field with its spellbinding legend Messi, but off it as well. Thanks to global Messi marketing, the Argentine Football Association, or AFA, is arguably the world's richest national soccer federation, worth more than $1 billion. But the AFA is also under FBI investigation in Miami for allegedly laundering perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars. If Argentina is what's right about soccer today, it may also be what's very wrong with it. We'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Shirsho Dasgupta, reporter for the Miami Herald, who's covering that FBI investigation into all that Argentine soccer money moving through South Florida. Also with us is Eduardo Gamarra, political science professor and Latin America expert at Florida International University, who's just published a book, De Argentina al Mundo, From Argentina to the World, that traces the country's phenomenal soccer power. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Shirsho Dasgupta, the Buenos Aires Daily, La Nación, broke this story last week about the FBI investigating tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of Argentine Football Association money moving suspiciously through Miami and U.S. banks. U.S. authorities then confirmed it to the Miami Herald. Now, we knew the Federation opened an office here in Miami 3 years ago to great fanfare, but tell us about the Miami company that's at the heart of this alleged money laundering probe.
So South Florida couple, Javier Ferroni and Erica Gillette, incorporated this company called Tour Prod Enter LLC in Aventura in mid-2021. Now, what's interesting about this couple is like they don't have any apparent connection to soccer and or global sports management.
But the purpose of the company was to handle the international sponsorship revenue, which is huge, of the Argentine Football Association, right?
Correct. Yeah. So later that year, they become the soccer association's agent for international deals. And we see hundreds of millions coming into this company from, you know, Adidas and Warner Media and other companies after they play friendlies abroad. Now, we know that this company right now is the subject of a civil litigation in Argentina, claiming that the soccer body's use of the company violated a contract with another agent. And we also know that they are part of at least one criminal proceeding in Argentina as well, involving some of the same things we covered.
And of course, we should mention that when the Miami Herald went to visit the quote offices of this company, it really didn't exist.
I mean, they were leasing an office space in Argentina, which was owned by another recently incorporated company that Ferroni and Gillette had formed in Florida. That company still owns that office space, as in the second company, but Tour Prod Enter is not operating out of there anymore.
And here in Miami?
Yes. And you know, some of the other things that we found in the records was that around 40 million were transferred to Miami shell companies.
Right. I want to get to that. I remember a decade ago when we were all covering the huge corruption scandal involving soccer's international governing body, FIFA, and several of the national governing bodies in this hemisphere, like Brazil's. Shell companies were the big modus operandi of their financial fraud. And that obviously appears to be the case in this latest investigation. Shisha, walk us through what you found in your examination of the records, as you were just starting to mention. And surprise, it involves Miami condos, right? Who would have thought?
Right. As I was saying, we see like at least 40 million going from Tour Prod Enter to around like 9 shell companies. And why we think they're shell companies is because they're all recently formed. They have no apparent business activity. We couldn't trace the people who are listed as executives. They don't seem to have any employees. And we found that separately, Gillette and Ferroni at around the same time incorporated some other companies and bought properties in Sunny Isles Beach. And, we see some transfers, not the whole amount for these purchases, but, you know, money moving from Tour Prod Enter
right
to these same other companies that made the purchases.
Hence the FBI investigation into whether all this Argentine Football Association money is being moved in nefarious ways through these suspicious channels. Eduardo Gomara, I want to pivot here from the investigation into the Argentine Football Association's money to the origins of all that money. In your book, you lay out the intriguing story of how Argentina, both football and finances, became the wealthiest soccer brand in the world in the past decade. It of course, involves their legendary player Lionel Messi, but also Asia. Can you briefly walk us through how this marketing marvel happened? Do we have Eduardo on the line with us? Eduardo? I guess
I am on the line.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Not that you're having trouble hearing me.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Got you back.
The story of the Argentine Federation is really an extraordinary tale of marketing genius and I would say institutional growth. Argentina in 2017 was facing a huge crisis, really from 2014 to 2017, a dramatic crisis that in some measure culminated with Argentina not being able to win the World Cup and not having much success internationally. And remember that Messi was a player in the Argentine Cup, mm-hmm. In the Argentine team from the early 2000s until 2017. But Messi even resigned from soccer, from the national team in 2016, in large measure owing to that crisis. But what happened was a dramatic shift in management and the management structure. And it was bringing in fact, some talented management skills in the face of a man named Leandro Peterson,
right,
who designed this global scale, this idea that Argentina was not just an Argentine thing, but it had to go global in large measure because of what was happening, the great phenomenon that is Messi, but also a number of other players. You know,
right.
this is a commodity now.
And in your book, you point out in 2018, the Argentine Soccer Association had only about 10 international corporate sponsorships. Today it has?
Roughly about 130.
Yeah.
Right. And everybody now wants to partner with AFA. And the greater the success, of course, the more these partnerships are flourishing.
And especially in Asia, right? You write that China, yeah, India, Middle East, Lionel Messi and the Argentine soccer squad are the soccer rock stars, right?
Correct. I mean, China is one of the most remarkable stories, but so is a small country like Bangladesh, for example, right? And
uh-huh.
that's tied to an anti-British sentiment as well. And the fact that in the 1980s, when Maradona made the famous goal, it was shortly after Bangladesh had achieved independence from Great Britain. And so,
yeah,
so to a large measure, there are a number of factors, both historical, but really it's the marketing strategy,
yeah,
that these individuals have forged that are responsible for the success.
And Eduardo, as I mentioned, as part of its global marketing strategy, the Argentine Football Association opened an office here in Miami, in Wynwood, a few years ago, the first international office of its kind for that association. So what was the impetus for that, and why have so many high-profile figures here, like former Miami mayor and current Miami-Dade property appraiser Tomas Regalado, who's now the association's, quote, ambassador here? Why have so many of them gotten involved with it?
Well, you know, to a large extent, Tim, you have to understand that Miami has become a very significant sports capital,
yeah,
in different sports. When Argentina began looking at Miami, Miami was about to go into the Copa America, the club's world championship, and of course, 7 games of the World Cup. So in large measure, the focus on Miami was going to be intense. And what AFA did as a strategy, it looked at Miami as sort of the launch pad for a strategy aimed at expanding its presence throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this includes not just, you know, offices and the like, but it includes a significant number of academies that are sprouting up all over the United States that are teaching the Argentine method. And you'll also have to note that,
mm-hmm,
you know, at the World Cup, 9 of the 48 coaches were Argentine,
yeah,
including coach of the U.S. team.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Eduardo Gamarra of Florida International University and Sirsho Dasgupta of the Miami Herald about Argentine soccer and the FBI investigation here in Miami into the Argentine Football Association. You can join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Sirsho Dasgupta, you reminded us in your reporting that Argentine Football Association President Claudio Tapia was in Miami recently to see Argentina's dramatic victory over the underdog Cape Verde, for example. The focus of the FBI investigation into his association seems to be that Miami company we discussed earlier, Tour Prod Enter. But Tapia and the association bosses are very much in the U.S. authorities' crosshairs as well, no?
Yes, I think when a case like this happens, sort of the immediate question that comes up is who's benefiting. So
Yeah.
because Tapia and his sort of aides and other top leadership in AFA were in charge when these transactions took place and these deals took place. They are the FBI is obviously probing whether it was them who ultimately benefited from these transactions, which otherwise should have gone to the Argentina soccer
Right,
system,
the
basically.
allegation, the possible allegation being that all that AFA money was being channeled, if not laundered, through these shell companies, for example, here in Miami, and then perhaps funneled back to people back in Buenos Aires for luxurious personal use, for example.
Correct.
Yeah. So, Sircho, where does it look like this FBI investigation into the Argentine Football Association money and its handling in Miami is going now? How long could this take?
So our sources have said that it's still in sort of like the preliminary stages, and they're looking at everything. But complex investigations like this, which involves hundreds of millions, multiple banks, multiple countries, this can take quite some time, maybe even a few years, honestly.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Eduardo, I also have two quick questions here for you. First, in spite of its remarkable success both on and off the field, Argentine soccer appears to be a cautionary tale now. What is the lesson other soccer federations and we as soccer fans should take from everything that's going on right now?
Well, Tim, one of the things that I learned in writing the book is has more to do with whether Argentina is an example that other countries can emulate, right? And in some measure, I conclude that Argentina has some characteristics that are very difficult to emulate, in particular the passion, and particularly the passion and the gut that you see at the very end of games,
Yeah,
right?
right.
That is very difficult to teach. Now, looking just at the role of somebody like Messi, it's important to have a Messi, certainly, right? Would Argentina have achieved this without Messi? I told you before that Messi was there before, but Argentina didn't achieve the kind of success that it's had in the last 8 years. So somebody like Messi is an important component of success, but he's not the fundamental part of it. The remaining part of it, I think, is really institutional. And this is where perhaps the cautionary tale, and it's really a very important cautionary tale. I think it's very important to differentiate really AFA and the Soccer Federation from the leadership that is currently under investigation, right? What you have developed is an institution that really other countries ought to try to emulate, just simply because of the professionalism that it has within it.
Yeah.
But one of the problems that we always face, and soccer is not different than anything else, but in reality, you always face the problem of leadership
Yeah.
and accountability,
So
right?
who's going to win on Sunday, Eduardo? Argentina or Spain?
Well, I'm convinced that Argentina will win on Sunday.
So, Florida International University, Eduardo Gamarra is author of De Argentina al Mundo. Sirsho Dasgupta is a reporter for the Miami Herald. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, on the roundup, no matter who wins the World Cup on Sunday, we in South Florida have already been rewarded by playing host to fans from myriad countries like underdog Cape Verde. Some of Cape Verde's biggest fans were in Fort Lauderdale.
I ask God to protect our Cape Verde national team, a small country but with a lot of faith and a lot of strength.
Scotland's Tartan Army even played bagpipes outside a Miami Marlins baseball game.
I ask God to protect our Cape Verde national team, a small country but with a lot of faith and a lot of strength.
And Norwegian fans brought their famous Viking rowing to Miami Beach.
Row,
That was absolutely delightful. On behalf of South Florida, I'll say thanks and come back anytime, folks. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Chris Young. Welcome aboard, Chris. Denise Royal is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.